lose something. So as the last speaker of the first group, I'm very happy to introduce Andrea Kollnitz to you. She is an associate professor in art history at the Department of Cultural Studies and Aesthetics, Stockholm University, and was previous senior lecturer at the well-known Center for Fashion Studies, Department of Media Studies, also at the Stockholm University. Thank you for being with us, Andrea. Your research interest is very much into national issues since quite a time, and we are happy now to turn from the Second World War, post-World War period, to the First World War period, if I understand well, and it's your podium. Thank you.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and thanks for your introduction. Heidi has been a loyal follower of my research. We have some crossings. So, and it's also a kind of sequel to your speech, Valerie. Since the beginnings of fashion, visual fashion discourse has played a paramount role in creating and consolidating difference and power relations in political and national, as well as class and gender-based identities. Focusing on images in European cultural magazines during the period around the First World War, I want to highlight fashion as expressive, dramatizing, and clearly differentiating costume for different satirical characters on different national stages, and problematize the impact of visual stereotypes based on strategic contrasts in clothing and body types in political discourse during times of national and international crisis, times not unlike the ones we live in today. The political explosiveness and performativity of fashion caricatures from 100 years ago resonates in the impact and power of today's fashion media, as I claim, as a tool of visual and sartorial identity construction and performative differentiation in a period of nationalist uprisings around the globe. Comparisons between early 20th century depictions of fashion and dress in the warfaring nations of Germany and Britain and the neutral zone of Sweden show significant variations in the discursive function of fashion, as on one hand emphasizing and triggering political, racial, and ethnic antagonisms between the nations, and on the other, negotiating power struggles between the classes and sexes in societies dealing with the terrors of war, while at the same time handling the rise of modernity. Inspired by theories of performativity and theatricality, as well as the thinking models of classical rhetoric, I will present examples from three previous case studies looking at mainly Swedish Strix and German Jugend and Simplicissimus, where representations of the French as the other served as a national war between the sexes under the challenge of modern women in Paris fashion, destabilizing traditional national values, but also British Punch and its staging of a national theater. National Theatre of the Classes, with distinctively dressed characters during the early years of the war. Fashion must there be seen as a metaphor, a powerful instrument of cultural politics, and a far from harmless carrier of national symbolism during an era of revolutionary political changes. My initial choice of German and Swedish cases was related to their being interlinked by the negotiation of a common Germanic identity during the period, an identity building that demanded demarcations, not least towards outlandish southern or western European influences, such as France, that was predominant as a cultural power in both nations, not least when it comes to fashion. Practicality versus elegance, controlled and natural masculinity versus exaggerated and stylish femininity. These binaries resonated in the Swedish and German discourse constructing Frenchness in the early 20th century. The alleged femininity of French style was ambivalent, though, inferior in a politically and nationalistically charged rhetoric, superior and an unsurpassable model of artistic creativity in the universal regime of fashion and art. visual distinction and science of Frenchness through conspicuous fashionability can be exemplified through a series of caricatures in Swedish Strix from 1916, displaying exaggerated black eye makeup of young waitresses, shop assistants, and certain ladies. One drawing shows an extremely black-eyed shop assistant addressed by a stout elderly gentleman who wants to be shown some stockings. The girl lifts her skirts and shows her own legs dressed in aggressively black tights, a gesture connected with sexual invitation that was present in 18th century fashion culture. The black eyes and black hair, not least in combination with black tights, hidden under a proper bright dress, give an impression of French physiognomy and Parisian pleasure life. The Swedish shop girl with her suspiciously unblonde hair is to embody a Parisienne. As Valerie Steele has discussed, from 1850 onward, the figure of the Parisienne became an international icon. As a woman of exquisite taste, fashionable appeal and beauty, showing and enjoying herself on the boulevards and in the nightlife of Paris. She combines upper-class exquisiteness, lower-class practicality, and moral liberty. The notion of Paris frivolities, its female inhabitants embodied by the Parisienne and its less distinguished counterpart, the grisette, are admired icons. They warn of female liberty and metropolitan decadence and are repeatedly depicted in Strix. A link between Swedish city life and women showing off their fashionable appearance in public and the Parisienne becomes possible not least because the latter was considered a supranational figure, not bound to French citizenship. As Agnès Rocamora states, La Parisienne is impervious to borders because Paris itself, according to discourses on the French capital, is borderless, open to all. Other caricatures connoting Parisianized women types on the move show the notorious waterside promenade of the Strandvägen, one of the richest parts of Stockholm, as a place of awkward rendezvous between modern fashionable girls and ugly elderly gentlemen, mistaking their friends' daughters for prostitutes. The visual contrast in those images consists of extreme silhouettes with tiny waists and seductive poses in the fashionable light-footed girls and their physical opposite, the heavy-limbed, elderly, upper-class gentleman trying his luck in vain. A more aggressive critique of the fashionable woman and her demoralizing effect on national society is communicated by images showing pairs of women. This is a bit later, the 20s, but images showing pairs of women in movement. In extravagant dress and wearing delicate shoes, they quickly and self-consciously move through the city. Their conversation is about cheating on their husbands or exchanging their boyfriends for superficial reasons. Shoes, coming back to these, actually make a significant marker of contrast. The unrealistically slight, high-heeled female shoes that can hardly be expected to provide support for walking and the broad, formless, but solid shoes of the traditional male provide one of the most striking examples of a critique of modernity that is strongly connected to physical characteristics. These metaphorize modern metropolitan flux, lightness, and fickleness against traditionalist national stability and stagnation. While feminine unreliability expressed through foreign urban fashion and fashionable manners makes one of the main messages, their meaning is more than just a comment on modern women. It is about national insecurity under the impact of modern influences, metaphorically connected to the rise of the emancipated new woman and the dangers of speedy changeability expressed through excessive and ruthless fashion consumption. National authenticity and integrity is at stake. However, a final observation demonstrates a crucial ambivalence inherent in the fashion discourse constructed in Strix. While the modern woman and her fashion seem to endanger the status quo and undermine conservative national virtues, they simultaneously enhance the beauty and validity of Stockholm as a growing cultural metropolis with continental habits. Fashion as a cultural quality marker is evident in illustrations of beautifully dressed Parisian girls that accompany sentimental poems called chansonnettes, papillons, bleus, etc. Similarly, the imagery in Strix presents and emphasizes the beauty of French aesthetics while warning about its decadent effects on Swedish morals. An ambivalence in the experience of modern and Frenchified fashionable women and men is also evident in the German magazines Jugend, Youth, and Simplicissimus, both published in Munich. German cultural political relations to France were more aggressive and oppositional compared to Sweden's generally quite affirmative gaze at France as a style model. Although a stylistic model in art and fashion during long periods of German cultural history, France became an opponent in the Franco-Prussian War and an outspoken enemy after the First World War. In 1900, though, French and Parisian culture were still admired as they promised modernity and renewal, ideals that mirrored the ambitions of Jugend. In Jugend, romantic naturalist drawings staging innocent German youths dressed in simple, timeless clothing in idyllic German Alplandscapes, a dreaming young girl leaning against a tree or a shepherd boy lying in the grass, are often directly followed by so-called Parisian images, a feuilleton of far more dynamic drawings presenting contemporary Paris and its pleasure life, with titles like Champs-Élysées, Jardin de Paris, or just Parisian images. They present a visual reportage of what's going on in Paris. Paris, an obvious icon of modernity, is expressed by predominantly Parisienne in fashionable dress, overtly sensual poses, and elegant makeup, often suggesting their belonging to the demi-monde. In Jardin de Paris, three Parisian ladies of doubtful profession gaze at the spectator in an alluring way. All three are wearing voluminous hats and heavy eye makeup. Two of them grasp the cloth of their fashionable, lavish dresses with their scarlet-red details, thereby emphasizing the form of their hips and exposing their legs and high-heeled shoes. Though exotic and seductive, these women emanate a notion of aggressiveness and menace, not least as they appear directly after the image of a shepherd boy with closed eyes playing his little flute on a peaceful meadow full of sleeping sheep. In accordance with the role of Paris as the internationally known city of pleasure during most of the 19th century, Jugend puts the modernity, fashions, and dynamic lifestyle of Paris into a both romanticizing and disturbing contrast to the nature, traditions, and people of provincial Bavaria and Munich. Parisian ways, women, and fashion definitely play the role of the other, but are included in the modern and national spirit that Jugend seeks for its readers before the war. Contrasts between urban modernity and rural tradition become more ambivalent in the magazine's caricatures. In The Wasp Waste, two peasants in typical South German folk costume, short leather trousers and feathered hats, gaze at a fashionable lady who is passing by quickly. Reacting to her tiny corseted waist, one of them says, "If she were mine, I would keep her in my hand." The question is who we are to laugh at. The provincial peasants, keeping to their old-fashioned views on women as property and unfamiliar with modern values, or the extravagance and unnatural dress of the modern woman that deforms the laws of nature and tradition. City and province are opposed by the means of contrasting dress and physiognomic types. The passing woman can be interpreted as a German counterpart to the Parisian passant de mode, a fashionable passerby in the streets of Paris, and a romanticized fugitive female version of the male flaneur. She connoted unavailability and the poetry of the modern elusive beauty, especially when shown from behind, as is done in the caricature in Jugend. The caricature's title furthermore indicates an aggressive and dangerous wasp as analogy to the modern fashionable woman. Another drawing with an ambiguous message shows a slim, fashionable lady gazing at a stout peasant woman in folk costume. When she comments on the peasant's breast and awful hips, her male partner insinuates that she's just envious. Both of these images contrast fashion and traditional clothing, and they also oppose two body types, which are of metaphorical significance for the nation: a modern, cosmopolitan, unnatural body, connoting affectation and artificiality, and a traditional national natural body, less beautiful but stronger, healthier, and presumably more motherly. The image of women and their French fashions carried a still more striking national importance in the sarcastic caricatures appearing in Simplicissimus in the 1920s. At this time, Germany was suffering from the economic misery caused by the excessive financial burden placed on it by the Treaty of Versailles, which had ended World War I, and also ordered Germany to pay reparations to the victorious Entente nations, including France, thereby laying the groundwork for continued German hostility toward France. One highly dramatic and aggressive example is a cover which says, "Off with French luxury." The image shows a muscular blonde German man in simple grey worker's clothes kicking a black-haired, elegantly dressed woman carrying a pile of French luxury products. The French woman's tiny pointed feet and shoes are high up in the air, while the brutal male's comparatively large feet in their clumsy shoes both kick her bottom and meet the ground. The printed subtext reads, "We have our own liquor to drown our worries." Antagonism between the sexes is a powerful rhetorical trope and consistently repeated in the political and cultural debate concerning German-French relationships from the 19th century to the 1930s. Germanic virility and seriousness is opposed to French or Latin feminine weakness and disposition for superficial, purely sensual concerns. In this drawing, the feminine image of France as a national disturbance is still more confirmed by the connection to French fashion and luxury products, undermining masculine German values and economic national strength. While I have chosen to limit this presentation by quite leaving out the many performances of male stereotypes in national costumes, uniforms, and other attires in the visual war rhetoric of Simplicissimus and Punch, I will end up with discussing some of the stereotypical German and British women roles staged as counterparts to their both foreign and male opposites. In contrast to Simplicissimus' drastic, polarizing caricatures of warfaring male figures in differing uniforms, which we see to the left, or stereotypical popularized notions of national dress, here we see an artificial French man and a cowardish Englishman and a wild Russian trying to bring down the German oak tree. In vain, of course. This is 1915. And to the right, we see a typical cover of Marianne, the French national symbol, the symbolic personification of France, of course, here embodied by a fashionable, seductive, dangerous woman. So, at the side of these drastic caricatures, we often see something, and they are often in combination with strongly exaggerated and distorted physiognomic types with nationally typical landscapes. We also find something very, very different. Painted illustrations with ideal depictions of German women, girls, and their relationships. They show ideal bodies displaying fashionable yet moderate dress as the perfect costume for the average German as a model of national identification. The characters look stylish, but never conspicuous. The ideal German woman is constructed as genuine and beautiful, but modest, in elegant but natural attire, different from the excessive fashionability and dangerous outspoken femininity connoted by French fashion. These very same decorative prints, coming close to beautiful fashion illustrations, are sometimes turned into a different genre through the addition of ironic texts. An interesting practice that exemplifies the closeness between fashion illustrations and satirical images when it comes to show off fashion and allure, as well as to amuse. As an example, we may look at this one called Barbarenmädchen, Barbaric Girls, from 1915. We see four pretty girls in neat and fashionable home dresses lingering around a table, smilingly checking a map in a bright, friendly room, an idyllic image, pleasant for the spectator. The textual joke, however, ridicules the foreign discourse on Germans as barbarians. as these girls are conspicuously sweet and refined, and their conversation actually is about fearing for the doves on the square of San Marco in case of an attack, which shows their naive, innocent, not to say stupid, attitude. In the very same picture, depending on its context, dress is thus used both as a realistic or idealizing costume and as a tool of irony. A similar effect of fashionable ignorance is achieved in the jokes of Punch, which continuously put the cruelty of war in contrast to the ignorant and irresponsible coziness of bourgeois lifestyle. For example, an innocently looking small girl sitting on the floor tells her beautifully coiffured and dressed mother, who is sitting on the sofa and reading the newspaper, "Oh, mother, how I wish I was an angel." The mother asks, "Darling, what makes you say that?" "Oh, because then, mother, I could drop bombs on the Germans." Reality and lack of reality, true war efforts and naive imagination are juxtaposed in a drastic joke efficiently staged in an elegant feminine scenario. Significantly, both Punch and Simplicissimus, representing and supporting nations at war, different from Sweden, stage the fashionable bourgeois or upper-class woman as a signifier of ignorance, vanity, and egotism, as in the joke Die Frau des Internierten, the wife of the interned, to the left, where a selfish, fashionable wife enjoys herself while her husband is in jail, and to the right, another example called The Worrying Housewife. And you see the joke. Again, decorative fashion prints, originally supposed to please the spectator, are used for harsh criticism against superficial women in the newest, often French, fashions. Idealizing fashion plates in combination with bitingly ironic titles or subtexts are used as misogynist accusations towards conspicuously fashionable women, attacking the superficiality and heartless vanity of female fashion consumers who keep to their fashionable needs when there is so much else to be concerned about. As a further escalation of the theme, a headline in Punch used four times during 1915 says, "People we should like to see interned." In a British society with an intensifying class struggle and rising Republican and Democratic values, the people that we, that is the editors and artists of Punch, as representing the British people, would want to see interned are exclusively upper-class women in fashionable attires of contemporary elegance. Thus, a lady in fashionably narrow black dress combined with a huge white fur muff and high hat, the very long and thin feather in the newest Parisian style, accompanied by a small dog with a large bow, tells her hosts, "You really must dine with us on Sunday. I shall have a couple of the dinkiest little wounded subs to show you." This exemplifies a macabre social phenomenon, the showing off of male war victims in high society circles, and their objectification or even fetishization by the beautiful and cold-hearted female sex as representative of the upper class. Likewise, two ladies of conspicuous elegance, one quite fat, the other extremely thin, who come to see a normally shaped and obviously sound hospital nurse. In the background, we also can catch a glimpse of three wounded soldiers. "Well, we'll bring the car tomorrow and take some of your patients for a drive. And by the by, nurse, you might look out some with bandages that show. The last party might not have been wounded at all, as far as anybody in the streets could see." In those jokes, we are confronted with drastic, not to say aggressive, contrasts and polarizations, both in social and in visual terms. The antithetical staging of elegance and conspicuous beauty or superficial fashion against the wounded, damaged and uniformed or poorly dressed young soldiers who are to be shown off like freaks makes the latter signifiers of truth, honest patriotic commitment and genuine misery, while the ladies and their fashions become scaring examples of selfishness, falsity, and stupidity. A useless class, discursively connected to and represented by a passive and shallow feminine sphere that should be interned. In conclusion, My analysis of fashion-related images and visual tropes in Swedish, German, and British cultural magazines from the first decades of the 20th century reveals the importance of fashion as part of an ideologically charged visual culture, where French fashion or fashion as such figures as a model as well as an oppositional other to national fashions and identities on one hand, and as a performative costume for different social roles in a time of political and ideological transformation on the other. Satirical figurations of modern, conspicuously dressed women during and after the First World War can be interpreted as tools in a war against women, against modern women, enacted on the visual and conceptual premises of fashion. Those women and their fashionable physiognomy are furthermore used as metaphors for a perceived feminine aesthetics and attitude that both weakens and simultaneously ennoble the nation and its culture. As we have seen, the trope of the fashionable woman can be seen as a trans or supranational phenomenon of strong discursive significance, not least as the passive or shallow other also of male heroes actively engaged in the war. And this is a very telling picture, of course. It says the sensations of the season, and we can think about what sensations would be the most important ones. And this is the end. I will return to men in another presentation.
Thank you very much, all the three of you. I think for the discussion, we will have our two speakers here.